Welcome to the Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter at securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
There's so many different layers to it. Like, it's this there's CrowdStrike's technology. There's CrowdStrike's process. There's Microsoft's technology. There's kernels. There's the EU apparently caused the whole thing. You know, there's just so many different elements of, well, we'll start with finger pointing, but the realities are so multidimensional and highlight, I guess, some of the real big challenges of how we actually go about protecting our kit.
I think what we can focus on is the lesson learned that come out of that. I think as we think about it in the context of disaster recovery and business continuity, a lot of the times we focus on the big systems, right? We're thinking about an ERP, how do we get this back up and running, and don't really take a good hard look at some of the connective tissue that ties all of those together, right? Think about, for most of us that are doing single sign-on, if you lost an Okta, a Ping, if you lost Entra, for those of us on the Microsoft stack, right? That now that's the gateway into all of those ERPs. Have you really contemplated what's my out of band? How do I still get people access? Because we're becoming more and more reliant on third-party software that in many cases, if we think about it from the lens of a single provider, is a single point of failure. Now they may have much more complexity built in, so it's not a single point of failure within their ecosystem, but CrowdStrike showed to us what could happen with one major provider on a global scale. And I don't know anybody that would have predicted that.
I was saying, you know, are you talking about it from a, I guess there's a couple things I want to peel into there. One of which is the idea of over-consolidation, meaning there is one market, there is only one market leader, and therefore everyone is affected. You know, the AWS issue. If we joke that if US East 1 goes down, we don't really have to, we won't really have to figure out how to recover our systems because the entire internet would be down and right, no one could get there, like that kind of thing. And CrowdStrike being so market leading, and I know that some of CrowdStrike's competitors will take umbrage to that comment, but the fact that they own the market really does mean that, you know, there was a huge impact. So do you buy for the best, or do you buy for the underdog, knowing that if you go, that you won't be part of the mass, you know, everybody to Azure, because if they go down, nobody gives a shit.
Right.
So with the finger pointing, though, I was going to say it's a good place to start, because every time you point the finger, how many are pointed right back at you, right?
Right.
And as you built upon that, then talking operating systems, this wasn't like, you know, oh, if Ford's trucks, a particular one went down, everyone driving that Ford truck has issues, right? This was more along the lines of, this wasn't a traffic accident inside Michigan on I-94 that left anyone traveling in that area down. This was the idea that suddenly all the concrete on all these major roads all of a sudden just turned back to mush and nobody could move, right? Until you went in and plugged in, you know, whatever the chemical ingredient was to make it all turn back to concrete so that everybody could go back moving again. It was a direct boom, hard stop, nothing moved.
Yeah.
And I don't know enough about concrete. I'm not a civil engineer, so I don't know one thing concrete. Boom. Yeah. Great joke.
No, I know. I use
that as the analogy, right? Like, you don't see that happening, and all of a sudden when it does happen, it's like, whoa, right? What do we do? And that's, to your point, Eric, that fabric or that tissue, right? Those applications or services have become platforms that everyone's dependent on. And when that platform's tied in, not to the connective tissue, but directly to the heart, right? And you send an update to the heart, and now the heart stops, the whole system kind of shuts down. And I think that's kind of what everybody saw.
100%. And I think a lot of it, so if we think about it in the context that I'd like to say that in our field, the only definitive is there's no definitives, right? That there is no, I think you guys would agree. Number one, you can never say you're totally secure. And we can never say that 100% certainty that any system, that this is always going to work, that nothing's ever going to go down, right? So we're in the position of we're balancing risk. And at the heart of what we do, we are risk practitioners, right? So you're starting to look at it as you're looking at the different vendors in the space. You know, I'm not saying go out and find a lesser vendor, because the bigger of the targets is going to be naturally the market leader, right? Because there is, you know, for instance, I was having a conversation with legal recently on a video I did for one of our partners. And one of the questions was, is there an intrinsic benefit for us in doing this video? And I said, yes, right? Because if I can drive more customers to a vendor, they have more data, they're seeing more, which increases their efficacy, which in turn then helps protect us, right? Because there are going to be companies that are going to see certain types of threats before we ever do. You know, right. This kind of goes back to, we're not that special, right?
The idea of buying for parity and building for competitive advantage. And none of this is a competitive advantage for any of us.
Right. Yeah. So I think as we're balancing some of those risks, we just have to be cognizant of that, that if we are going to go with a market leader is going to be pushed harder to come out with features. They're going to need to move faster to maintain that market leader position. But as well as on the adversarial side, they are going to be a bigger target. Not that CrowdStrike in this instance, you know, was the result of an actual cyber attack. But as we think about, you know, Microsoft, the Amazons of the world, I mean, granted, there's really only three primary cloud providers until you get into Oracle, OCI, and some of those, that's just part of the overall risk equation and understanding that as we grow the footprint in these, they continue to become a bigger target, which means they could lead to a bigger issue. Who knows?
But in theory, they're better positioned to defend against that than any one of us could in our own data centers.
Right. But that's also, you know, as we think about checking out the risk of third-party management, those are answers that, number one, probably don't have the skill set internal if they were even willing to show you what their plan is, how they're actually handling their resiliency. So there is a huge, huge element of trust.
It's back to an automotive related topic in DFEMA, PFEMA, right? The reason it takes so long to bring a vehicle to market.
Wait, can you buy that from Amazon? Is there like a lexicon database that we can get for
Brad? You can get these in the marketplace. Acronyms.com. But the DFEMA, PFEMA, when you're producing a finished good, right, a product, to go through the design failure mode analysis, then the process failure mode analysis, and then a low volume production trial, and then a high volume production trial to say, yes, this is ready, let's push, right? The reason the software industry can move faster is you don't have to produce an actual finished good off an assembly line to go back and validate the process to the design to make sure you can produce at a certain volume. But what you do have the capability to do, right? And the reason you can do it much faster is that that's all done in code, right? So it's the same process from a design failure mode to process, and then a low volume trial, high volume trial, because you're testing that code, right? Seeing where there's redundancies, where there's things that when pushed, right? What here has dependencies here, and what does that play with? All that should be validated and tested.
So I agree, but I'll challenge your analogy to manufacturing. Because I think in manufacturing, I don't want to downplay the complexity of it, right? But there, in my opinion, there's a limited set of variables that you're testing for that you can tweak to see what the ultimate impact is on components. As we get into software, we can only test for the known knowns. And what bites us is the unknowns. And trying to plan for something that we've never seen before is huge. Now, in the case of CrowdStrike, my understanding is this was kind of a two-pronged issue. Number one, that whether testing was done on it, I would imagine there was, but Microsoft had an update around the same time. So the channel file that was pushed out didn't play well with the update, right? So in this case, I feel like that should have been testable, but I think in a software perspective, there's just so much more complexity and variables that you're trying to play with. Not to say that we should be in a position of helplessness where I can't do it, so we're not going to do anything. I think we got to find ways to continue to be better. And in that case, I do think there are lessons learned from manufacturing, but I think software in general, just because of not being a contained, like manufacturing to me would almost be like the dev saying, hey, it worked on my box. Right? Because you're testing it in the confines of a safe space that you've created. Software doesn't get to play in a safe space. You're going into hostile territory and trying to predict what is to come.
But I agreed to all that. None of those things came into play in this particular issue. This particular issue was the channel file went into a configurator, and the configurator before it ever went out, went into the validator. The data went through the validator didn't know enough to know about this particular issue. It went out the door and to the CrowdStrike client, to the agent that's installed on all your machines. Excuse me. And the agent, and then the agent who lives very close to the sun, AKA the kernel.
The agent is Icarus.
This whole flying too close to the sun theme has come up multiple times over the last 2 weeks. And it got too close to the sun. And the sun, in this case, didn't devour it. The sun just fell over dead when it saw this file. And so I think none of this has to do with variability. This has to do with using the avenues available to you to their fullest, but without understanding, without really thinking through the implications of what could happen. If you do, just because you can,
So if I'm hearing you correctly, the argument is that they were allowed to get too close to the kernel, causing essentially a panic, which ultimately created that if we would have put the guardrails in place and said, hey, no, sorry, the line starts here. This is as close as you're going to be able to get to the door until. Yeah.
Right. Unfortunately, the trade-off is this is the method for creating, you know, in order to protect a system, you do have to get as close as humanly possible. You have to reduce the number of injection points that somebody else can get in between you and the sun. So you have to live close.
Yeah, well, and I don't want to defend CrowdStrike in this case, but there was a history that many of us would have made the argument that up to a certain point, where all of a sudden Microsoft made the change internally where they said that security has to sign off on anything going out the door, and truly started to pivot towards being kind of a security focused company, that they had some of the most, So they had some of the most epic vulnerabilities out there. And many of us looked at them, they'll go, why would I trust you, the creator of some of these vulnerabilities, to protect yourself? Why would I pay you when you created the backdoor in the first place? And I think so from that lens, that would have been the CrowdStrike push. Well, Microsoft, if you can't do it, let us do it for you. And that got us into that position of being that close to the kernel.
Yeah, but there's been
Probably explain what the kernel is for listeners.
The kernel is the brain of the operating system, effectively. It's the broker of all conversations, of all actions. It is literally the center of the universe of an operating system. Commands come in, commands get executed. Other operating systems have put a layer around it, an abstraction layer, to keep people from directly accessing the kernel, to limit it. Think of it like an API layer to keep, you can get it all the good stuff, but only in the way that we let you get it the good stuff. You know, that's in place in macOS. Which has led to the Delta CEO making the comment, you don't see this happening in Apple. But the other piece in all this is, you know, Microsoft has had this staunch, unwavering, and we'll call it tragic hero style commitment to backward compatibility. Like, if you run a Windows 3.1 app, it'll probably still run on Windows 11. You'll get a lot of ads for other Microsoft products along the way, and you'll have to run an E7 license to do it. You have to own an E7 license to do it, but you're going to have this type of compatibility. Enter the registry that has, you know, is 30 years of cruft all built together. So, but this is one of the reasons that I guess they had been loath to put some abstraction layers, because it would require some changes. Other operating system manufacturers have said, we're going to make your life hard for a week, but we promise it'll be better in the long run.
Apple.
No. Linux has done the same thing. I mean, it's not just Apple.
Can I go back and defend and argue just a little bit on my automotive manufacturing concept here? Because again,
well,
The OE, original equipment manufacturer in this case, instead of it being Toyota or GM, right, would be the Microsoft, okay? And if you make a change, right, regardless, if Toyota or GM say, hey, we want to change the length of this seat rail, okay, for your seat to be more compatible with this airbag system in this one vehicle, we're going to push this change. But they notify the sub-supplier, because that seat rail might be common across every single vehicle you build. And if you change the distance on that rail for the one vehicle, then the airbag systems and all the other ones become non-compliant, because now the seat can't go forward to meet the requirement by NHTSA for the airbag to protect my face from slamming into it, right?
But it'll protect the vein in your head.
Oh, that hurt, actually. I wasn't thinking about that when I slapped myself in the face. Hopefully everyone's watching the video. So my point to that, though, is, and that's where that PFEMA, DFEMA come in, because now you got to go see where the dependencies are for that one part number across all other vehicles that you built. And that same seat rail actually may be common with a Honda or a General Motors, who decided to use the same seat to cut down costs. So they didn't have to buy extra tooling, but it has a different part number in their system that relates to a sub-supplier part number that then relates to all the customer part numbers upstream, so you can find those dependencies.
Right.
That's where I go back to the idea of code. Go ahead.
But all of that is cost cutting and corner cutting. Everything you described was an artifact of corner cutting.
Cost and overall capital investment, but you still have to have traceability to go back. That's where, when we would talk with those OEs and they'd be like, oh, we love this, we're going to save all this money. And then a year later in production, they're like, we'd like to make a design change to that. We're like, we're sorry, you can't, you don't own the tool. They do, right? You wanted a cheaper product, you got it. Now you can't make any changes and you're stuck in that, right? But that's what you're going to live with for the next 5 years. There's way more flexibility, right, and the idea of building code and SaaS application, et cetera. But these have become platforms that our customers live on. But they all are kind of dependent on the operating systems they play with. And the closer you get to that airbag system, that heart, right, and start to make changes or do something. And this is where I see, like, and again, I'm not finger pointing here, but that relationship that Microsoft needs to have with, sorry, everybody else, right, for anyone playing that close to the sun, to be able to let them know when you're making changes and here's what you have to meet, right? Like, if they did make change X, that when this person's out testing code, they can't depend on what they just tested for the last 2 months. Now they got to cycle that up to meet that requirement there, right?
Agreed, but you need to have commitment to your convictions and forcing the issue may be the right thing to do if you're so high and mighty. As a security company now, if you're so committed to this, have the convictions, have the balls to say, by this date, you will do this, and we will deep six the registry, and we will deep six the kernel, the direct access to kernel or kernel extensions. And we will do things because this is what is right for the user. This is what is right for people, not what's right for you people who are building stuff on top of us. It's going to be painful, but you know what? We're going to bring you along on the ride because it's good for you too.
And that brings it right back to the automotive side, because at the end of the day, it's about the person driving the vehicle and the safety of them hitting the airbag.
Sure.
Right? So like you said, it goes back to, is this the right thing to do for the consumers, right? Not just everyone that's selling a different software application, service, security product tied to this.
Right. And that's been the different focus between different OS manufacturers. I mean, in my mind, I see this as way more as a Microsoft defect, go figure, than I do a CrowdStrike defect.
I mean, this kind of makes sense. I mean, kind of tying, Dan, what you said about the legacy supportability of applications that Microsoft has historically gone to great lengths to allow for their customer base, with Brian, what you're saying on the PFEMA, DFEMA, that it's the longer we continue to allow the complexity of backwards compatibility, it makes it exponentially harder to run all of the different test scenarios that need to be done to understand the impact from software. But I'm actually still in the camp of getting closer to the kernel and trying to get through some of the outside of the layers of some of the operating system control. And I think some of that changed for me in talking to a CEO of a company. So he was a founder and CEO that is in the OT space, and talking about where they play and trying to get outside, specifically outside of the network stack that is controlled within the operating itself, its operating system itself. Wow. That looking at it through the lens that within the operating system, that maybe the intent was good going in the default configuration, but people can change all of that, which decreases security, which lessens the impact of their tool and what they're doing to try to protect some of the connectivity, that if they can get before the user or any software, anything can start manipulating some of the security within the OS, the more secure you're intrinsically going to be, because you have less variables that can be toyed with. Now, as we've seen, the closer you get to the kernel, there's also more risk, right? That the damage that can be done is far greater. But I think there is still an argument to be made that to not create a further abstraction layer from some of these tools, that they need to get as close as possible to the kernel.
Or at least create a graceful exit when it happens. Yeah. The idea of the fuck you blue screen. I mean,
sorry, it's an industry term for everybody listening.
Yes. Well, no, but that's the full name of the blue screen is the fuck you blue screen, because that's really what it's telling you.
Right.
As a user, you're absolutely hosed. And I mean, the idea of graceful fail, the idea of useful information other than, sorry, you rebooted. The ability of recoverability, the idea of recoverability is also, is also tough. But I think I want to move us on as well, because there's another component to the recovery. And some of this is nothing to do with CrowdStrike. This has to do with the use of security technology that actually inhibited the recovery. The idea of BitLocker keys as a necessity to be used to get into safe mode. So for those of you who don't know, there are generally requirements and good practice to encrypt machines. So if a device gets lost, stuck at TSA, not to use the airport analogy because they were the heaviest affected, but you know, if you lose your machine, if a machine gets taken, physical access usually means you win the game. You can get into the machine. You can get at the content on it. There's a lot of machines out in the world. Some of the biggest hit in this were the kiosks, the Delta kiosks at the airports. These are devices that are exposed to people. So you want to protect.
What was that outside of Southwest? It was because they're running on a Commodore 64, was it?
There was. But you can choose your seat.
Shout out to their marketing and PR team though, because while their punchline was great, they even ended it with "Go to hell." It was like,
did we ever confirm that that was a real post from Southwest? I don't know. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. Have a look. Tell us in the comments what you think, if you think it's real or not. But I want to go back to this. So the encryption is in place. We do this on Windows. It's called BitLocker. It's part of the operating system. It encrypts the entire disk. In Apple, it's called File Vault. Again, it encrypts the whole disk. But in doing so, they also put a protection on to keep you from trying to break into it. So you have to have the key in order to decode the drive. So if you start up abnormally, like in safe mode, which doesn't put launch all the additional services, it has you put in the BitLocker key so that it can decrypt the drive. Good thing. Problem is, this means that when you go to recover a system that's in this state, you actually have to walk up and visit each one and input the BitLocker key. So this recovery was partially hampered, and I'm trying to be very fair about where we put, not blame, because it's not about blame. I think it's about understanding of where along the chain certain things changed the game. In this case, having to put a BitLocker key in changed the game in that it required a physical visit to every one of these machines, many of which were designed, built, and implemented with the idea that no human would ever have to touch them again because of all the automation systems. So this was a big hurdle in the recovery.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Brian. I was going to say, it also opened up not just the fact that you had to go in and touch it manually, but then you had to also go locate your BitLocker keys. And for some companies that had gone through different transitions, you know, where management had left, new people had come in, IT teams had left, IT people came in, you hadn't had to really keep track of these for a long period of time. So it was like getting shoelaces with a pair of shoes as a secondary pair of shoelaces, and you stored them somewhere and you have no clue where your shoelaces are. So when the time comes to physically change your shoelaces, you can't find them. So
one other element, Microsoft said you can't use shoelaces because you don't have the right license, and therefore we have to count on you to store your shoelaces at home. We won't store them centrally.
100%.
To translate that in, if you weren't this tall, if you didn't buy a good enough license of Windows, you could use BitLocker, but it couldn't be stored in the right way. So some of this also is arrogance that comes along with how you build the OS and basically say, user, you're on your own. Go ahead, Brian.
And Eric, I'm just throwing this out here because there was a few companies I had to work with during this period of time that were like, as we're checking in to see how things are going, right? They're like, well, everything's good, except for the fact that, call it bad, call it good, but some of these old ones, we just realized we don't know where the BitLocker keys are for them. Yeah. So it's going to force us to have to get rid of them and get something.
That's why
new.
We just write them to a text file every day into an open share that's available to everybody. So that we've got, no, I'm just playing. But yes,
and what's the URL for that share?
Actually, it's just on my Twitter feed, so don't worry about it. It's accessible just in case, you know, it's a DR plan. But if you think about it, a lot of this, so if we go back, not just the licensing from Microsoft, but it's exacerbated by the technology change over time, right? BitLocker keys used to be managed, I think, by nothing, and then MBAM is where you would put them, and now that's transitioned to Intune. Right? So those of us that are using Intune to write it to the computer object, it actually works really, really well.
Yeah, it did work well in those cases where it worked.
But I think what this also gets into, as we've talked about many times on this show, is how we're implementing controls. That this idea that there's just this universal control that has to go across everything is not the right approach, right? Is the risk profile to a kiosk really risky enough that we need to encrypt it? Is there really that much data on there that we have to be concerned that somebody's actually going to break into an airport, which is federal space, pull one of those things out and extract something of worth off of it? I don't know. Well, I'm not in that space.
In that case, it's actually an enabler of access to the reservation system.
Sure, maybe. But again, the risk, what's the risk profile of one of those actually being pulled out? I couldn't tell you. I don't know enough about that space, but
I
know
difficult
as we
do that from time to time.
Yeah. BitLocker responded the way it was supposed to respond in this.
Yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the way I wanted to respond. If a laptop goes missing, I wanted assurances that I can say that any data that was on it was not able to gain access. But we also, at the same time, as we make the decision on what gets BitLocker, what doesn't, is we're choosing specifically, as you think about the plant floor, does it really need to get BitLocker? No. A lot of the bits and bytes that are coming off of the machinery doesn't mean anything to anybody, is not considered sensitive data. So really, is it that big of a deal to encrypt it? No. The risk is actually even greater if it gets locked up and stops production. So that becomes a risk-based decision. We're not going to do it there. And you have to think in those terms rather than just saying, well, I'm holistically going to do this everywhere, right?
But how much of that is a reactive answer, the pendulum that swings to the other side? We just got burned with it over here. So now we're going this way. And how much of that is the right blend of risk for you?
I agree with that. Not saying, yeah, I think we could all look back at our past and say, well, we've made reactive decisions to events that have happened. But I think that's one of those things that as we look as security practitioners, well, I've always said that we always have to be willing to say we were wrong or we have to change, right? That if we all of a sudden become this mentality of, I built this baby, don't touch my baby, then we're going to lose in the end run. Because the decisions we made yesterday, as we look at them through the context of today, may not be the right decisions, and we have to be willing to pivot and change. So I think this is one of those opportunities to start looking back that and start playing out some of those scenarios. If something like CrowdStrike was to happen again, and BitLocker, the inhibitor it was to bringing operations back online, is it really worth the risk going forward on these type of devices? And if the answer is no, then it's not, what's the reason behind the control?
So two things there too. One is, what I really liked that came out of it was watching how some teams, and they put it up online on LinkedIn, et cetera, showed how they band together, got both, you know, the security teams, the IT teams in, the help desk teams, everybody together, and they accomplished something as a team in a very short period of time. Lessons learned from that, and I'm sure on the Delta side too, and again, I'm making assumptions here. This isn't something that I've read or I've had conversations with a CEO there, but as you came back online, then asking the questions, one, why was this so difficult for us? To your point, Eric, because our policy states that we have to do this, this, and this, is this the right policy for these devices over here?
Right.
What did it protect us from? Oh, that's a good thing, right? Like when we go back to the idea of why you add a little bit of friction in, at the end of the day, if that platform, your security platform goes down across every single device, was the right thing being able to say, hey, everyone's got to go manually touch this to update it? Hey, it did what it was supposed to do, and we were still protected because of X, Y, and Z, right? That's a benefit. Now, from a business standpoint, the impact of getting us up online took longer. Here's what the impact was to us financially. Could this happen again? We need to run this back through our scenarios with other things that live as a platform, and then go back to those platforms that get closer and closer and closer to that kernel, right? Which is our heart. I would also like to point out too, though, what I was very surprised with, and again, I'm only on one social media platform, LinkedIn. So I'm not on the Twitter, the or X, Instagram, some of the other Meta.
Insta-Twitter.
But to me, it felt like, maybe I just lumped some of those together, sorry, was the fact that, to me, it felt like 50% of the community was out there saying, don't be mad at CrowdStrike. This, like, I can't believe everyone's so mad at them, right? Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, guys, at the end of the day, somebody took somebody down, right? Like, it wasn't a cyber attack, right? But this goes back in. And I looked at it as like, I wanted to hear more about not pointing the finger, right? But how did it happen, right? Like, it felt like, for every 10 articles I read, only one gave me a little bit more information on truly what happened between Microsoft and CrowdStrike, right? And then dissecting the information that came from CrowdStrike that I thought was good and then trying to verify, right? Trust, verify, and trust, but verify. Going through all of that. But I felt like there was an unresounding, this could happen to anyone. Well, not really. This wouldn't happen to just everyone or any software company out there. There's things that happened, right? Or things that failed to happen that led to it. And it's what you do moving forward that tells me, yes, I'm still going to trust you. Because there was plenty of people I talked with that maybe were in the process at that same time of evaluating different EDRs that were like, and I use this as a good basis, and I'm just putting this out there for anyone else too. They were like, I don't think I want to do a 3-year contract and I'm being pushed into this. And it was right at their end of quarter. And I'm like, if I were you, I wouldn't. I tell them that you want that 3-year price, you're going to do it for 1 year. Right. And you tell them that I don't care what letter you write to me, what assurances. I don't care if you bring your CEO on to say it will never happen again. I'm sorry, you got to prove it. And to prove it to me, you're going to give me this price for 1 year. And if you prove it, then I'll do a long-term contract.
Yeah, I think we'd have to, the comment around this could have happened to anybody. I think if we look at it through the context of making a mistake that has downstream ramifications, not talking about the magnitude, right? If I look at it, a small tweak I made a couple months ago that was like, oh, you know, this will increase our security posture, took all of our conference rooms offline. And I had to manually go around because I screwed it up and put in the damn password for everyone. Not great. Things do happen.
Did you have to put the dunce hat on too?
Yes. Yes. There was very much the, I'm just looking down at my feet, making my way to each one. Not a great moment, but yes, I do agree with you, Brian, that if we look at the potential magnitude of impact, there's not that many companies out there that could have this type of reach on a global basis. But I do look at it through the lens of a comment Dan has made in the past and looking at companies that have had a breach that it's, and drawing the analogy to the restaurant that got shut down by the health department. And they come back up, they are probably going to be the healthiest company at the time. And this sucks for CrowdStrike, but the amount of litigation that's still to come, government scrutiny, and their own just them being embarrassed of what they had to go through, I do think that there is, you will see some changes internally, whether it's lip service or not. We'll never really know, right? But I think the hopes is as they come out on the other side of this, that you're going to see a change in behavior where this won't be as high of a risk for them in the future.
Dan, I need you to try to back up what Eric just said here, because even though that health restaurant or that restaurant might be better, the best time to ever eat at it coming out of that, you got shut down because of health risk. If you read the article, as a patron to that restaurant, and maybe there was a picture of a rat, it's hard to get the picture of the rat out, even though you know they're probably safe. It's like,
no, Brian, that was a Disney movie, Ratatouille.
Easy, by the way. But
I was gonna say, remember the old? Well, Eric, you might not remember this. There was a show in the 80s called "You Can't Do That on Television." What do you think's in the burger? But I think there's two things at play. One, there's response, the reaction, the response. We're judged on the response. But there's a second piece, which is culture, and the culture of quality needs to be there, and it needs to be. If it's not instilled, it needs to be continue to be instilled. And I can't. You know, I can't speak to internal operations at any companies other than the ones I work with, but I think that's part of it. From my understanding, the tools that were used, this wasn't somebody went off script. This isn't that somebody went off script and decided to make an approach or make a change in reality that was not tested, not anything. The person used the tool. The tool didn't function, didn't catch a fringe item, and it went out into the world. So the thing does happen. I think this is different. This is not, I have systemic rats in my restaurant. This issue, at least, is not that I have systemic rats in my restaurant and one finally got noticed. I think it's, a meteor fell from the sky in my restaurant and now I'm out of business. Do I plan and build a meteor shield? Yeah, my meteor shield was only good enough. I'm sorry, I'm notorious for really bad and obtuse analogies. And this one is playing right into that. Oh my God. did something, the 500 years flood happened and I didn't have big enough seawalls because I only planned for the 100 years flood. You know, it was so out of left field. It wasn't as though, again, this is from my understanding and the reports I've heard, again, including from leadership at CrowdStrike, is that this was not that somebody went rogue on a process. It's that using the existing tools, which have worked very well up to now,
right?
The process failed, and the process does fail. And you know what? This is the case where if I were Brian, I would say, you know, when somebody noticed, they should pull the cord, and they did pull the cord, and they then pulled back and stopped the release. But there was an issue, you know, some defects had gotten through the line. So this one's hard. And I think it's not about blame. I think it's about how they move forward. Do I think they'll move forward? I think their stock price and their market cap and the lawsuits will encourage them to move forward. There's an impetus there, but will they change? I don't know enough to know if there's cultural changes needed.
I just have to say this, and it goes back to automotive. Okay.
Really? Really, Brian?
I'm being serious. When you're the vehicle manufacturer, when you're in charge of the baby in the back seat, the mother in the front passenger seat, who's ever driving the car, there's an impetus on you to make sure you validated all the checks. Any change that comes close to a Delta S, which is a safety critical item, which the seat structure has over 50% of them, right? You have to then go through a certain number of low volume trials, high volume trials, and it's expensive because you got to get all 1,000 suppliers to give you 50 parts of each, and you have to build 50 vehicles and you have to crash a few. That's why any change related to any of those items is scrutinized so much, because the cost to implement the change because of the testing required is tough. I look at this, I don't give a crap what tool simulation you ran it against, what we plugged it in, it ran the cycles, everything was good. When you play this close to the sun, when you're in charge of the passenger and the seat in the back and the infant and the toddler, then you have to have a low volume production setup with computers and software that we're going to run it through in a high volume. And the cost of that, it requires capital investment, which none of these companies have. And I talk about it all the time, because how does your price go up 5% every year when you're not making a capital investment? When you actually publicly show that your stock price is $400 a share and you grew by 100%, but you only hired 20% new people. Sorry, make a capital investment. Your stock price demands you make the capital investment. Playing that close to the kernel, you make the capital investment.
I would actually argue. I'd make the argument in your example, Microsoft is actually the OE, and CrowdStrike's just a tier one in this case.
Yep.
100%.
And
they are the brakes.
One elemental difference, however.
I agree with you, Eric. I should have stated that too. I circling that back around, they are the OE right there. And in their case, hence you have responsibility.
And I'm purposely, this whole discourse has been purposely to the far end of this for the purpose of the debate. And I'm going to stay there for a second. The difference is that in the seat world, you don't have new people coming to shake your seat while you're driving in a way that's different than they did yesterday, like you do in the threat world.
But apparently you're just not driving enough here in Michigan, Dan. Because there's new potholes every day that are shaking everything.
We fix the damn roads. That's all I know. I was going to go into Washtenaw County. We did an assessment early, so our roads are actually fixed now. So the point is, unlike seats where you have a lot of testing time, the threats aren't really changing significantly or dramatically on a moment's notice. And this is one of the other elements that comes into this whole thing is, you know, the automatic acceptance of signature files, the automatic acceptance of you know, channel updates and how fast, what's the trade-off between getting them fast to reduce the threats that are changing multiple times per day and putting testing in place, what level of testing, you know, robust testing, like you described, can take time.
Right.
What is that trade-off? And what do I, the one who has to live with the ramifications of an attack, now have to, what's my trade-off? And in this case, my trade-off is I would rather have a small bit of testing, like smoke testing. You know, I'm in a software world, so you do smoke testing, make sure it doesn't break anything, which I'd argue in this case may not have happened correctly, because you put this file against any Windows machine and boom, it should have been pretty clear pretty quickly. But you do a small amount of smoke testing, and then I want the protection as quickly as possible, as long as it isn't going to break things. I still stay in that realm. Now, I hear from others who are, well, we want to manually check every signature file like we do a patch. Ugh. And that worries me in my world because of the speed of change. And I think somewhere between the way you described it with capital investment and robust testing, there's robust testing, which takes long periods of time. There's good enough testing to get it out the door, but there's benefit to the time element that goes into it as well, that I think we need to take into account, that is different than in the automotive seat world.
My prediction is we're going to see more of these happening. And I think part of it, that if we think about it in a video game, it's almost like Asteroid, right? That you've got so many different asteroids that are on their own different trajectory. And as we push more and more for agility for all these companies, we want things quicker. We want features. We want updates. That is, they're all in their own different orbits and testing that as I'm about to come out with a release and another one comes out in the operating system I'm living in, if they all of a sudden collide, we start to get some of these catastrophic ramifications. And I do think that we're going to see this more and more, unfortunately.
So is the answer the suite? Is the answer a coordinated set of things within one organization that handles the entire life cycle top to bottom?
No, I don't think so, because so maybe it depends, but I think if we think longer term, that as you go consolidate into a suite and you start to have vendor lock-in within that, that disincentivizes that suite to continue to be agile and continue to innovate, putting us right back in the same position. So I think, I don't know what the answer is, but I think there's a different lens that we have to find to start looking at this thing.
I think that also too, Eric, to your point there, it also goes back to risk appetite, not just in security, but for innovation, right? Like if we go with this suite, these pieces of the suite are really good. We really like that. These not so much. Are they going to innovate this and innovate fast enough where we're moving, right? Or is there an appetite then to move to other point solutions, not just in security, but business related point solutions, right? But we also have to understand the risk appetite, both from security and how we create that fabric, like you called it, Eric, right? Internally to manage all this, right? So I do think there's a lot there. And again, when I was going to the idea of the investment and everything else, I think it comes back to the PFEMA side too, when you look at, if you were to create a risk model for what things do we need to test with a little bit more accuracy, redundancy, et cetera, right? That goes into the idea of how they do the scoring, because they don't have to do that for all engineering changes made in a vehicle, right? But those that get closer and closer to safety critical, things that have been deemed safety critical, but that took 50 years, 30 years, 20 years of describing what is safety critical. I think we can start to do that just from a business standpoint of what's critical for us in our environment, right?
And but then those Monday morning quarterback, Brian, until two Fridays ago, no one would have said this change was critical.
Well, it's like, as an analogy, I almost think about this where speed is our enemy, right? But it's a necessity at the same time. So as we think about a kid learning to ride a bike, right? You start to learn to ride a bike, you're going extremely slow, you're falling all the time, but each fall that you have doesn't hurt that much, right? Because you're at a low speed. You get older, you're getting better at riding the bike, you fall less often, but when you do fall, now it's going to hurt more. And there's a whole element of you being older and being more frail. Yeah. But as you get to our age, right, I'm really good at riding a bike. I'm going to keep getting faster and faster. The same thing with responding, what you were saying, Dan, responding to cyber threats, that we're not going to fall as often. dear God, when we do, it is going to hurt. And that's kind of where we're at today.
And that's why Monday morning quarterbacks are so great, Dan. That's why a quarterback that plays on Sunday and fails, who would have thought Jared Goff would take us to the playoffs all the way to potentially a Super Bowl? The number of times he fell down and had to have a Monday, you know, that Monday quarterback, right? Lessons learned. So, and again, like, it's easy to point fingers, but you always have a few pointing right back at you. And I say that for my own self in terms of this conversation.
And full disclosure, when Brian says us in that term, he does not mean me.
I really like this conversation too. And it was great to get a little bit heated right during it. Cause again,
couldn't tell.
That wasn't me like mad at CrowdStrike or mad at Microsoft, right? That's me mad at the process. And for years of being beat up in automotive where they're like, you guys just move too slow, right? It's like, yeah, it does take time for those things to happen. But when it comes to safety critical, right, those things have been put in place. But a lot of that was put in place because of regulation, right? And the insurance industry also helped drive some of that, right? Five-star crash rates, NHTSA, everything else. So it's been a combination over years of lessons learned in Monday morning quarterbacking, right? And then you're seeing that come at a much faster pace, right? But software moves so quick. You do need to be agile and be able to make changes. But as you get closer and closer, I think, to that operating system, and then companies themselves, just like Delta CEO, had to learn, right? How did this happen? You have to understand your technology even better. So it's not just about being super good at business and understanding the dot, you know, the ones and zeros in dollars. It's understanding the ones and zeros in bytes and how your business operates off that code.
And we all got a free disaster recovery test. Everybody wins. And on that note, we're out of time. Brian, Eric, thank you so much for the great conversation and debate. And thanks to you, the listener, for being here. We love having you and we love your feedback. You can reach us at info@distillingsecurity.com. Our website is distillingsecurity.com. Great Security Debate is part of the Distilling Security Network. And we've got some ideas for some new shows coming up soon. So go to the website, go to Distilling Security. In the top, there's a little form to fill out, very light. First name, last name, and email address, get on our newsletter. We're going to keep you in tune on what's going on. We've got some live events that we're starting to think out. But most importantly, you'll know when new shows launch and when new episodes are available. You can find us on the Twittergram, whatever Brian called it. we're at Security Debate. We're on LinkedIn. We're on not much else. Because I don't know that social media buys much anymore unless you're in 5-second snippets on TikTok, apparently doing silly things. thanks so much for being here. We'll see you again on the next Great Security Debate.